Okay, everybody, we're back after a nice lunch and group photo. And we'll start the afternoon, and we're finishing up with the questions and answers. And if we don't get to all of them and you want one answered, just put your name and address on the question and you will get an answer, okay? Just in case we don't finish them all. They've certainly been wonderful questions. Why is it a we program instead of a me program? Why can't I just make conscious contact with God and transcend all the rest of you sorry SOBs? Well, I think you could, but we wouldn't get to watch you, and that would be the deprive us of seeing that such a huge amount of spirituality concentrated in. There is a fine distinction between the we program of 11 of the 12 steps and the I program of the 11th step. As Bill writes, that is an individual adventure. And we decide what course of action we're going to follow, what type of seeking. We are the ones. And it's the most underdone step of the program. Would be the 11th step, in my opinion. We just spend so much time on individual discussions of individual problems, which would all go away at once if we so just focused on conscious contact. You follow what I'm saying? But rather than do that, I want to discuss why I feel nervous when my boss is making cutbacks, and why do I do this? Which is interesting, but it's missing the whole point of being here, which is to get home to God, at which point it'll be irrelevant what happens at work. So it there is a distinction, and it really is a individual decision and adventure. So I like that question. My sponsor says it's okay to get angry when things happen. It's how we handle it that counts. I say it's not okay to get angry. What do you say? This question is pissing me off. Well, certainly, I disagree that anger is a dubious luxury of anyone. I just don't understand how anger could be a positive thing in a spiritual life. Now, whether it's possible to never get angry, that's probably out of our reach. We can pray and stay as centered as we can, and then when we feel the anger coming on, we can concentrate on getting rid of it as soon as possible, which is covered beautifully in 10th step in the 12 and 12. It would be nice to never get angry. I can make all kinds of efforts in that direction and get up and pray to be thoughtful today and to not have things bother me or whatever. But I think the ultimate thing is, don't let it hang around very long. I used to tell people, when you get disturbed, do not move any further through the day. Stop and get undisturbed. Now keep going, or you'll have a lot of amends to make. Still struggling with building personal bonds of my fellow man. Ways to overcome this. I still think that It gives us a chance, because we're in groups, to build these bonds. But the bond between you and yourself and God, if that is built, you'll see it coming out everywhere you go. You'll just see your fellow man differently. And if you see, in other words, your perception of the world will change, and you'll just intuitively be making these bonds that if you deliberately tried to do it, you could accomplish it, but it wouldn't be on the same grounds. And also, I like being a loner. I don't see anything wrong with it. When I'm in the hospital, I was in the hospital a lot in the last 4 years or so. And Chris he'd stand guard on the door and wouldn't let any visitors in. What do I do daily to keep myself undisturbed? Meditation, prayer, a decision that I'm going to try and not be undisturbed. My friend Ed Chandler used to go out the door every morning and let 5 people be wrong ahead of time. Other people have Tuesdays and Thursdays, everyone can drive any way they want. Now that sounds silly, doesn't it? Try it. Just get over, get out in the right lane, let everybody just do whatever they want, and then you get to work and you'll go, man, being on this highway didn't bother me today. So you can see this make being undisturbed the top priority. In the spiritual world, there's a new game. In the material world, the one with the most money wins. It's like Monopoly. Okay, that's the name of the game. The winner is the one with the most money. In the spiritual world, the winner is whoever's the least disturbed. You win, hands down. So you want to play this game, we got to find out how not to get disturbed, and if we get disturbed, how to get undisturbed as soon as possible. And you will see that if you're undisturbed, you have very little weight on your shoulders. The stuff that's crushing us down, the disapproval and all the things that are wrong and all that. It goes back to a question that I came up with that I just love. Has anybody today got a problem that's not bothering you? I don't see any hands. So, if we could get rid of the bother part, would it still be a problem? The answer is no. And so this is all going back to getting as close to contact with the higher powers we can and making a priority out of being undisturbed. You can inventory that yourself. Should I ever be afraid of God? I don't see any reason to. I think that's just a childhood old ideas. And I would personally get rid of it as just push it off to the side. I could see where the self-centered ego would come up with that in the same way it might, when we're brand new, be afraid of your sponsor. Oh my God, what's he going to make me do now? What other embarrassing thing? What else is he going to find out? Now I got to make amends. Oh, I'm afraid of, and all these things. But as time goes on, you realize everything that you are being put through is for your own good. And everything that God puts us through is for our own good. So never, whatever it is, it's for our own good. And later on, if we stay sober, and and have the eyes, spiritual eyes, to see it, we will be grateful. I mean, how many of us are grateful that we became alcoholics so that we could end up here? I'm just thrilled. But in the beginning, I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened. These are great. Can everything I experience and do become a tool for love and service? Yes, even mistakes. Mistakes may be the greatest experience of all. First of all, it shows other people that you're human. I think sharing at discussion meetings when we're going to discuss problems should always be a package. I had this problem, and this is how it got solved. Don't share until it's solved. You understand? Don't share until it's solved. What is the, it's like telling half a joke and leaving out the punchline. I mean, don't share until it's solved. Then you share a package and you have something of value. So, yes, every single experience is valuable. Am I going fast enough? What's your interpretation of perception of the fourth dimension? It is a total awareness of the presence of God and of my identity as a spiritual being. That's what I'm seeing. And it's something like these holograms that's already there. It's just that I can't see it. I cannot see the connection. And as it becomes visible, that's the moving into the fourth dimension. That is the transformation. That's the awakening, whatever it is. When those things come into focus, it's like an awakening. You just are jolted because you're in a different place. Sometimes we hear things, sponsors, meetings, that stop us in our tracks and change our whole perception of life. Can you share that, those that have stood out for you? Well, I think I shared Chuck Chamberlain. I mean, the whole weekend is built on there's only one problem and only one solution. Holy cow! If you just take that in for the next 6 months into your own life and try to see that all these little things that you're subdividing really are a manifestation of the one problem. And instead of going out and putting out all these little things, we just focus on the one solution and see it for real in your life. That's just unbelievable. And watching people handle things, that's another thing. I'm a big fan of Bill Wilson. He is just, the more I learn about him, the more I love him. I love him because he was flawed. I love him because he had to struggle against himself. And I love the fact that he never gave up and he just kept going and getting this thing in place. I mean, it just amazes me. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow. Is not the idea of God more important than who God is? Yes. God's a mystery, and we're never going to have that all totally revealed. It's beyond our every possibility for us to understand that. And so I think I said earlier, the key thing is to experience God. To experience God. to have an experience that you yourself attribute to God. And this can happen. Meditation, prayer, contemplation. I like that word. I like the idea of just going out and thinking about things, not thinking about problems. Just, wow, isn't this amazing? You know, how did this universe get here? Isn't this something real? And all of those are designed so that something happens to your perception that wasn't there before. And as you look around, you're so grateful for this new pair of glasses that Father Dowling gave that idea to Bill. What or who is the spirit in spirituality? What is its nature? What characterizes it? It's a mystery. I know we want to get a handle on this damn stuff. That's our intellect. We want somehow to be able to categorize it. And so what I'm saying earlier is it can only be experienced. It can only be experienced. And then you will have your answer to that question. But as you repeat that answer to somebody else, they're not going to relate to it. What does it matter? It's between you and this spirit, God, whatever you want to call it. And the trick of the game of life is to get contact with that spirit. I think about, God, everybody's playing games now. I don't even know how all these computer games work. But I see people in airports and everywhere, they're working on this and working on that. And they're almost in another reality. And I could see that if you spent 20 years playing some game, that could become your reality, and the trick would be to get the hell out of there. And we would tell you, this is not the real world. It's over here. And that, well, this is what we're finding out. This game we've been playing isn't real. The reality is the other dimension. And that's kind of fun. It's scary as hell because it means most of your ideas are not accurate. And so we start getting rid of them. Geez, these are fascinating. Are you sure the people in this room wrote these? Okay. Or did you have friends write them and then you brought them here? Okay. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Please comment on or elaborate what is it and how to do it. All right, what do we mean by the bondage of self? Self-centeredness. It's all about me. I'm alone in the, you hear Chuck talking there. I'm alone in the world. And I have to be the toughest, the best, the fightest, the tough. I got to be out there. That's the bondage of those ideas. The bondage is the perception that I'm separate and it's up to me to win the game and all these other people are in my way. That's the bondage of that. So the freedom is that we get rid of that idea and see another reality. It all ties into this same thing that we've been talking about. Does the lust thing ever go away? Yes, but you have to be over 80. And if it doesn't, can you give me some ideas on giving it to God without taking it back every 10 minutes? Actually, lust and all of these fit into the same category. And believe it or not, the reason it's still there is we don't want it to be gone. We really don't want it to be gone, especially men. You know, it's like, God, this is a very important part of me. I get some pleasure out of this, and I can feel better and this and that. And so we never make the decision to ask God to totally remove it. It really centers in that sixth step. We're entirely ready. And I think that a lot of us want most of it removed. Anybody relate to that? I'd really like, and Bill writes, who wants to be lustful enough to rape? Oh, not me. I don't want to go to jail and all that. I want to be under that level of lustfulness. Does everybody relate to that? Zero lust. What would that look like? Dead. I mean, what does that mean? And so what we want to be rid of is behavior that continues to bother us, whatever that may be. And the guy next to you may be doing the same behavior and it doesn't bother him. How is that possible? What does Bill say? Each person has their own sexual ideal as to what is acceptable to them and what isn't. And so the thing we're asking God to help us with is to stop a behavior that is bothering us. And so if you like to look at pretty girls and you do this and you do that and you go to bed at night and you go, I'm fine, then you don't have a problem. Somebody else may do that and feel they're the worst sinner in the world. And they're the ones who are going to have to change their behavior if they want peace of mind. Barriers versus boundaries. In the hole of the donut question, is it possible to allow ourselves to become out of bounds regarding day-to-day decisions when following guidance from the higher power, God? Sometimes I feel conflicted by quiet voice, which is probably my ego, or is it just common sense? Thank you. Remember something about that Bill said. It's one of my favorite lines. People of very high spiritual development always insist on checking with others the guidance they feel they got from God. So you want to be running things by people, just as a way of, you have friends, and can I run something by you? Can I run something by you? Especially guidance that seems a little amazing to you that you felt in a meditation sentence or just a quiet period or sleeping or whatever. And you just felt it, and it's very strong. God wants me to take the little Puerto Rican secretary and leave the country. Now, as you share that with your sponsor, he's not going to agree that that came from God, but rather from your ego. And so, to me, the whole thing is right in there. Check with someone else. Okay. Chris, it seems hot in here. Can we cut that down a little? Do you think brokenness is the only way to achieve the humility required to accept God's will and stop relying on ours? I see normal people establishing relationship with their higher power out of a desire to be close to God and not broken. Us, we weren't about to do that. We seem to be in the class that we need to be broken before. It's impossible for me to measure. Am I doing all right? Okay. That type of spirituality versus what we see in here. I mean, I just see people who somehow were born spiritual and go about their lives in a very spiritual way, etc. The only thing they're missing is empathy for the people that can't do it. They can't conceive of why everybody else isn't simply behaving themselves and having a lovely life. So they are not in a position to carry the message like we are, because most people are broken. Oh, an envelope.
Good year tires.
Yeah. Yes.
Frat house. What happens in Japan when a large boulder falls on a house? Okay. Okay. Oh, Howard, got it. Okay. Oh. We have a translator over there. While embraced in the process of pursuing a goal or participating in projects that have time deadlines, what insight can you share to make this one day at a time process more enjoyable? I think we covered it earlier. You make a top priority on being undisturbed. So in other words, I can remain undisturbed with three things going wrong at once. Good. Want to try for four? This is what happens at work, am I right? Yeah, I'm okay, I can handle this jerk, that jerk, and that jerk, but they just hired two more jerks. Now, we think that somehow we've got to manage this. No, we have to not let it bother us. You see what happens? If it isn't bothering you, you're handling it. And if you're not disturbed, you have much more energy and intuition to relate to the whole situation. So it just keeps going back to being connected and making a top priority. So now they have two more jerks on top of that. It's almost like, how many plates can you keep going and not have it bother you if one falls down? So remember the name of the game. Whoever's the least disturbed wins. What is the significance of Far Corners? I think it was in the organization of trying to have people with a good amount of time in sobriety come from the Far Corners and be with each other. And that energy in this room affects the message that I have prepared in a significant way. These type of talks, if this was a newcomers meeting, everybody would have been asleep a long time ago. You follow what I'm saying? So it was the hope that we could have people come from all over to be with each other. The second significance was that we deliberately decided that it wouldn't be an AA event, where we follow the preamble, we're going to cover the steps, we're going to put them on the wall, we're going to do all that. It's going to be a spiritual seeking event that happens to consist of all alcoholics or Al-Anons. So we have the common vocabulary and common background. And then I just looked forward every year to somehow having ideas come up for four lectures. And that gave me a lot of fun in preparing them or thinking them up or whatever, so that it would always be different when you come here. So that was sort of it. I don't know if we're going to get them all. AA history question. I often hear longtime members of the fellowship say that AA's future is in jeopardy. When did widespread concern over AA's future and the looming disintegration of AA as a whole really begin? Hasn't concern for the future of AA always been part of AA's history? Hasn't our history shown that AA can survive any passing fact, movement, or New York chicanery? AA was coming close to falling apart on different occasions, but corrective action was taken when Bill wrote the traditions. And it was there that we saw that there's the potential to follow the steps of the Washingtonians, or rather, see, the danger in a movement is when we succeed. All the struggle of having it together and all that is behind us. Clancy was telling me, he said, Sandy, you and I are lucky. We were in AA's middle age when the excitement, are we ever going to get it started in Minnesota? Are we going to get it started here? Can it go here? Now it's, oh boy, look, now we're in this country. We're in that. All of a sudden, it looks like the job is done in one sense. And so we don't need to be as vigilant as we used to be. It's like when you get 10 years sobriety, something inside of you tells you that you're not as desperate as you were the day you came here. Therefore, you don't need God as much as you used to, when in reality, you need him more. And so I think it's just a question of making sure that we adhere to the traditions and the concepts and the steps. That's all. If that's done, I think we're in good shape. Or maybe God wants it to all fall apart and start over again. What's the difference between truth and honesty? You can be honest without telling the truth because you don't know the truth yet. So before you came here, when someone asked you if you were an alcoholic, you could, if you really believed you weren't, you could say no, even though there are a lot of people who tell us they became an alcoholic after they got to AA. And they realized that they were, holy cow, I'm an alcoholic. So when I was saying I wasn't an alcoholic, I was being honest, but it wasn't the truth. So there's a big difference. Truth is something that is kind of beyond being honest. You have to seek it. It has to almost be revealed. So there's a big difference between honesty and truth.
Is absolute honesty truth?
Is absolute honesty truth? Well, that's a very good question. Absolute honesty would imply that you are committed to seeking truth. And yes. Yes. Boy, we're lucky to have Howard sitting up here. Is acceptance the answer to all my problems, like Dr. Paul O suggests in his story, or should I just not have a way? Would you holy cow, who is putting these things together? I'm getting a headache trying to figure them out. They're so good. Should I not just have a way? Would you expound on similarities or differences? Well, first let's start. I can't connect them in my head yet. Is acceptance the answer to all my problems? I am one in a very small minority that agrees with Dr. Paul that acceptance is the key to everything, which seems a little bit at odds with the serenity prayer. We're going to accept the things I can't change. And then there's the other category of things that can be changed, and I'm going to need courage. So acceptance covers this third or this half. Do you see where I'm going? I agree with Paul that acceptance is the key to everything. The reason it's the key to everything, in my opinion, is if I can accept whatever happened and get undisturbed with it through acceptance, I am now in a position to decide if anything needs to be done about it. If I'm still disturbed, I don't have the answer. I don't know the wisdom to know the difference. You can't get the wisdom if you're disturbed. So that's why acceptance is the key to everything. and then you know what course of action to take. If you're undisturbed, a lot of times there isn't anything left to do. All right, now, not having a way is a bigger solution to everything. If we could turn our will or our way over to God and not have a way, then nothing could not go our way. No matter what happened, it wouldn't disturb us. Then we wouldn't even have to engage in acceptance and courage and all that. We would be in a position that makes us absolutely invulnerable to events that are happening. So you can see this is a higher level thing, this not having a way. I don't know many people are going to get there, but it's a great goal. What is the greatest quality humans possess? Love. That's what I would say. Love and awareness of God. I think we were put here to become aware of God. And I'll talk about that tomorrow. I got a lot of answers in that direction, but I want to save them. Or another answer is being a Yankee fan. Okay, here we go. That's for the New Yorkers in the crowd. Have you ever had to fire a sponsor or discontinue working with them? Why? No, I had the same sponsor for 42 years until he passed away. This is all new territory for me. When I came in, you didn't choose your sponsor. Your sponsor was the guy that came to your house. And I never heard of anybody changing sponsors. And so, Sponsee. Oh, does this say sponsee? Oh, it does. Have yet to fire a sponsee. Yes, I have. I have people who don't want to work with me. I have a specific agenda. So if you want me to sponsor you, you come over to my house every Wednesday, 10:30 to 11:30. Here's the reading assignment. We're going to discuss it. They show up, they haven't done the reading, or they're not going to do that. I said, okay, you're obviously not willing, so go out, do whatever the hell you want, and call me in a month. Generally, they go, well, could I have one more try? And I said, okay, come back next week. But they have to follow the guidance. The assignments have to be done, or we're wasting his time and my time. And I could be working with somebody else. And I'm not mean. We often have little stories we think demonstrate a point or provide humor for closing our longer talks. Is that what it says? Yep. Oh, okay. Can you show one or two of your ha-ha closing stories? Wow. Yeah, but I can't tell, they're long. The Yale Junior Prom, that would certainly be one. And I'll tell it later. I think one of my favorites is just the dilemma in the chapter of the agnostic. And I hear that now that other people are using it all over the place, but it's that live on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death. What was our choice to be? And they call it a terrible dilemma to make that decision. And it's always struck me as humorous that you are given the choice of living on a spiritual basis or dying an alcoholic death, and you need time to think it over. I don't know why, it just captures my imagination. We sometimes hear how important it is to forgive ourselves first, but that isn't mentioned in the big book. Any thoughts on self-forgiveness? I sure do. St. Francis has it. It's right there. It is by forgiving that we are forgiven. So the way to forgive yourself is to forgive everything and everyone that ever happened to you. And the job will be done. How can you forgive someone who won't forgive? Okay, next one. 11-step meditation meeting in AA seem to be spreading in popularity. What are your summer thoughts about these meetings? I think they're wonderful. I think that each one is different, each one is unique, and it came about, it wouldn't have come about unless the people involved felt that this is what they wanted to do. And then when people come to them, they're either going to stay or not. But they could come back 2 years later and get tremendous value out of it. So I think it's wonderful, 11-step meetings. Is spiritual growth ever possible without pain? If so, how? If not, why? Well, spiritual growth involves crushing the ego. And you can, let's say it's painful up to the point. Bill covers this in the 12 and 12 in step 7. It's painful up to a point at which you see that the pain that you go through is producing wonderful results. And he calls that a great turning point in our lives takes place when we see humility as something we want rather than something we must have. We are now voluntarily going through pain, but since we already know it's going to turn out to our advantage, we somehow relabel it as effort. Was that too confusing, or can you see how the transition goes when you see the rewards coming? Okay. I recently moved to a new city and discovered the majority of the meetings chant and chime in on the readings. Yeah, I know what you're saying. And you can see, where was I somewhere recently? And the leader said, the Lord's Prayer ends with Amen. You know, in other words, keep coming back and all the things that got added and all this. After not being around that for several years, I now find it distracting and annoying. I also think if a newcomer thinks we're cult-like, that reaffirms it. Two-part question. How and when did that practice originate? And how do I let go the ideas that AA is getting compromised or watered down and accept that people will do this at meetings? I don't honestly remember when it first started. It certainly wasn't around when I came in. I'll tell you why I think it started. I think it started when the age level in AA got younger and younger and younger, and it just became fun thing, and I'm going to put my spin on it. And it probably happened when the leader at the end of the meeting, instead of saying, we'll now close with the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, he said, Joe, would you like to take us out? And then Joe said, well, I can be unique here. And he said, well, let's get ready to say the Lord's Prayer and think about all the hopeless people in this part of the country and other parts of the world that might be suffering and or may suffer later on or know someone who is suffering. And we suddenly had such a all-inclusive prayer that this guy looked cool. And somehow we wanted to put our own individuality on things. And I've learned to not let it bother me, as opposed to see it as some communist threat. So that's where I am. And I have no idea what new people think. I mean, boy, if you can figure out what a new person thinks, I've only got a few more. Here's a good story about that. There was a guy in the Columbia Pike Group in Virginia, Big Mike Walsh, and he was tough, big guy, and he was an atheist. And he closed his talk with "God bless you." So it was one of those things. And he told about growing up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and he was well-educated. He was a ship designer, but he just was big, and he loved violence, and his whole drinking was violence. And so when he got sober, he didn't like the meetings there because there were too many softies. There were too many people who, you know, I lost my job, and I got sad, and I came in. So he started going to meetings in Harlem so he could be with his element. And he got a buddy, and his buddy was an Indian who had been convicted of murder and had finally been released from prison. So the two of them went to the meeting, and they heard, boom, guns, knives, bam, and they're, yeah, yeah. One night, somebody made a mistake and invited this lady from Park Avenue to share at this meeting in Harlem. And she got up there and said, "Well, I was in my penthouse, and I had my flowers growing under the glass off to the side. And I had my little kitty cat would come and sit in my lap and purr. And my waiter would come out and give me my little wine. And everything was so happy and wonderful. And one day, the kitty cat didn't want to sit on my lap. And the flowers were all wilting. And the waiter, when he gave me the drink, had a look of disdain on his face. And so I joined AA and sobered up. And now my kitty cat sits on my lap, and the flowers are blooming beautifully. And the waiter gives me a little Coca-Cola with a big smile. Thank you all very much." They're leaving the meeting, and Mike turns to the Indian guy and said, "Holy crap, what did you think of that?" He had tears in his eyes and said, "That's the most beautiful talk I ever heard." So there may be a newcomer walking away going, "Oh, that mumbo jumbo ba 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 was the most beautiful stuff I ever heard," and they never heard anything else, and so they stuck around anyway. All right, we're down to three. Should I finish?
Yes.
What do you think is the most important character defect we can have God remove? Self-pity. That's funny. I've read more and more places that this hurts God the most of all the character defects, self-pity. He created something rather monumental for us. And instead of looking at it, we sit around feeling sorry for ourselves. That's my take on that. Why do people relapse after long periods of sobriety? Well, there's no way to know the answer to all of them, but I think we covered a little bit earlier. The illusion. One of the wonderful parts of spirituality is it works. But when it does work, it's possible for our ego to create the illusion that we are now much stronger than we used to be, and that we could actually pull God out of our lives and stay where we are. We just feel that we've been made strong enough to survive on self-sufficiency, and that's an illusion. And all you have to do is not go to meetings, not pray, not be talking to other people about things. And one of the things that happens when you do that is nothing. I haven't been to a meeting in a month, and I feel much better. I feel just the same as when I was going. And I don't pray, and I feel the same as though. Well, you don't understand. The entire foundation under you is just about to go, whoop. Now let's see you stay up in the air. And we crash. And it's all from the illusion, delusion, that we don't need God and friends and all that as much as we used to. That would be my guess. Two more. When does lust ease up? After 80. It causes me to get less spiritual. I think this is one of the great problems for men in Alcoholics Anonymous, is this, it is such a powerful pleasure that helps us in times when we're not feeling comfortable. I can just engage in this for a while. And the pleasure that comes out of it is so extreme. It is one of the highest level pleasures. I remember there was a writer named Orson Bean. Remember a comedy, a writer? He actually wrote a book about how spiritual an orgasm was. That it was up at the level where you're connected to God and all this kind of stuff. So there is such a high level that it is harder to let go of than others. And what gently makes us let go of it is we just get so tired of ourselves and just sick that we surrender. And that's the... It's not by accident. There was two or three questions along those lines. Last one. What do you do when or if doubt or cynicism arise in you concerning God? I would say that you could, if that happens, you can say you're in good company. Because that happened to Bill Wilson more than once. When you read the 12 and 12 in step 11, and he's talking about sometimes we may, I forget the exact words, we may refuse to pray. Absolutely refuse. I refuse to pray. He was talking about himself. He was talking about his depression and the pressure of being Mr. AA and all that. And he's writing the 12 and 12. In the middle of this. So here's an interesting thing. What do you do when you lose the contact and you're just going down? You just keep on going. You accept it. You just say, this is my lesson for today. And you keep right on going to meetings, helping in spite of that. Because we know it's going to come back. That's the beauty of faith. In spite of the evidence, we know everything's all right. So now we're in the spiritual classroom. Now we're going to have the lesson on faith. We're going to remove all your contact, everything that's making you feel good. Now you're going to operate on the faith and assurance that it's there even though it doesn't look like it. Everybody ready? And we pull it away and we go, whoa, Jesus, this is harder than I thought. And then it comes back. Now you've had the lesson. It has to go away to have the lesson. You have to be stuck in line for 12 hours to learn patience. Okay, you ready for a patience lesson? Good. So that's it. We're at the end of the time. Thank you all, and Chris will be up here. Wow.